I'm Gord Price, and this is Price Talks with a guest I've been looking forward to for a long time, the CEO of TransLink, Kevin Desmond. You are one of the rare, maybe only, CEOs who in transit is dealing with the problems of success. We'll talk about that.
It's a nice place to be. It can be a double-edged sword, but it's a much better place to be than the opposite.
Both edges of the sword. Let's see what we can do. But I'm going to begin with a question I know will be of interest to at least some of our listeners. Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of Elm Tots?
Of what?
Elm Tots. You don't know what Elm Tots is.
No, you see, you stumped me right off the bat.
All right. Yeah. We've got to get you onto Facebook and search for ELMTOT, Expo Line Memes for TransLink-Oriented Teens. Now, you got to think that that would be a rather small, it's a member only, Facebook, 1,600
is that right?
Members.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to look into that. I'm going to look into that. I bet you my guys know about that, but
right.
I should. Now you've embarrassed me.
Not at all. Really, what I'm wondering, if you go back to that age, whatever a teen is, let's say 18 to 20, would you likely have been one of those transit, bit of an insult to say nerds, but passionate about transit?
I hate to disappoint you and your listeners, but no. Now, I would walk from where I lived. It was a long walk, but I could walk to the number 5 Dyer Avenue train in New York in the Bronx.
Because you were born?
To get downtown. Well, I'm from New York.
Whereabouts?
I was born in Texas, but I'm from New York. I lived right outside the Bronx, backyard, back at my bedroom window. I was looking out at Co-op City in the Bronx, but right over the border in Westchester County. So the closest subway line was the number 5 Dyer Avenue.
And when would you have been taking that? What decade?
Oh, that would have... That's a rude question. That would have been the 1970s.
70s?
Yeah.
I'm thinking Bronx, 1970s.
The Bronx is burning.
This is not a pretty picture.
No.
What would you have seen from the number 5?
Well, first of all, what would you see on the number 5? So, yeah, those were dark years. You know, the early 70s, mid-70s, really all through the 70s were very dark years for the transit system in New York. You know, the trains were covered head to toe in graffiti. The trains were unreliable. They were slow. The subway system was falling apart. It was at the same time that New York City just about went bankrupt. The very famous New York Post cover of Gerald Ford to the city go to hell because they refused to bail out the city in those years.
So Drop dead.
Right. It was drop dead. So those were grim years. Now, you know, I was a teenager, so was I paying attention to the public policy side to that? I mean, my idea was, how do I get downtown and do stuff downtown? But I will say that growing up in that era and using municipal services in that era obviously had something to do with my sort of worldview as a public servant.
Well, I'm wondering, rather than giving you an interest or passion for transit, it did the reverse.
Well, you know, it ultimately made me realize that it is a tragedy if public officials, if government allows public assets to go to seed and to fall apart, whether it was the public transit system or just the infrastructure in a place like the Bronx, they were desperate times, and it was a shame to see that, what was going on. And once I, you know, when I went to graduate school and once I started my career and I sort of put two and two together between my experience of that as a user and as a citizen, as a kid or somebody growing up, and now seeing it from the standpoint of, right, how do you now manage that from a public policy standpoint? You know, I could put those two together, that's still completely...
Managing it from a public policy perspective, why would you have that?
Well, I went to graduate school in New York in public administration, so I'm kind of fascinated by public policy.
Well, what got you into that?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I majored in government in college. I've always been interested in government, not really politics. I've never had any interest in running for public office. I'm just interested in government and how government can make good things happen and drive the public purpose. And, you know, to me, public policy is problem solving. It's a different type of problem solving, but it's problem solving, and I like to solve problems.
Cliche alert. I'm thinking... Someone from Texas, in New York, in the 80s, you weren't, I would imagine, thinking about how government can work. You were thinking that government would be in the way. Again, a cliche. What made you different?
Well, No, I never thought of government getting in the way. I mean, look, I grew up, I began to understand government and politics when Richard Nixon was president. And you know how that went, right? Well, you know, I'm a child sort of the 60s. So I grew up in the 60s and Lyndon Johnson, the president, and the war and everything, and then Nixon and Watergate. And rather than turn off on politics, I was interested in government because I could also understand that government can do the right thing. So if good people of good intent are helping to run and manage government, then good things can happen.
What was the first door that opened to you that got you into public policy?
Well, when right after, I did internships in graduate school. I think my first internship was at something called the Community Services Society in New York, which was a public advocacy group for people of less means. So I did that for a summer. And then my second internship, in the summer, I worked for the Department of Housing Preservation and Development. And I'm gonna get geeky for you. I was in the NREM unit. NREM is Latin for basically buildings that were in tax foreclosure. And my job, it's all totally weird. I mean, this is the 1980s. It was sort of modern times. My job was to inventory the NREM properties in the city. We had these little 3x5 index cards before computerization, and we'd go out in the field and we'd have to inspect these buildings in Harlem and Bedford-Stuyvesant and Crown Heights in some pretty desperate neighborhoods. So these are buildings in tax remit, and so basically the owner had fled. And I'd go into these you know, basically slums, and I'll never forget. I think I was in Bedford-Stuyvesant or something in Brooklyn, and I went into this miserable three-story walk-up wood frame building, and there were probably about 18 people in the apartment living there, squatting basically. So I mean, these are eye-opening experiences. But my first real job right after graduate school was in the Mayor's Office of Operations.
You were going into some of the buildings, or at least the kind of building that you could see from the number 5 subway that you were taking.
Yes. And now, of course, they're all highly gentrified all these years later.
Could you have imagined that?
Is now this gentrified. No, I would never, ever have imagined that. East New York in Brooklyn was one of the most desperate places. They didn't even have grocery stores. And those communities are all gentrified now all these years later.
I'd be amazing. Looking for an Airbnb there if I went to
probably,
New York.
Probably.
Well, you're not so geeky that I don't know the backstory.
In fact, my son was just in New York with his fiance, and they got an Airbnb in Bedford-Stuyvesant or Crown Heights, one or the other, I forget which.
Well, I do know under the Dinkins administration, I think, maybe it was Koch, doesn't matter, that one of the reasons why New York works as well as it does is because of an amazingly large housing stock for lower and low-income people. The buildings that you went in and basically put into that housing stock, I think.
Well, you know, the buildings I went into were privately owned. That's why they were in foreclosure as opposed to the public housing in New York. But yeah, they have very extensive public housing in New York. I mean, you know, they were called the projects, though, for a reason. So they were, most of them, not really good places. I think, you know, years later, it's probably changed to a degree, but they were not. There was plenty of housing stock, but they were not necessarily great places to live.
Where to from there?
Well, then I started in the Mayor's Office of Operations when Ed Koch was mayor. It was his second term when I started there, which would have been 1986. Mayor's Office of Operations is this sort of policy group. We didn't do politics. We were kind of the bridge between the city agencies, OMB, and Office of Management and Budget, and City Hall. So we kind of looked after the operational elements of the agencies, and we were actually kind of the foil from OMB, because OMB was also always after their money. And we would often sort of get in the middle and sort of broker, well, you know, actually there are operational necessities, just cutting their budgets is not often the right thing to do. So it was actually really fun. But my first gig there, which lasted a little less than a year, was I was the junior cub and analyst for the Department of Parks and Recreation. So I sort of fancy myself as a, you know, granola guy taking care of trees. In this, that one of my first projects was inventorying the city trees, because the Department of Parks Recreation was in charge of all the keeping alive and managing all the city's trees on the streets.
There's a website we put up on Price Tags where you can go and online find every tree in New York.
I think when I was there, don't quote me on this, even though I'm on your podcast. I think there was like 800,000 trees that the Parks Department was keeping track of. So it was kind of cool.
You're moving up the food chain pretty fast here, it sounds like.
Well, you know, I was a junior analyst, but about a year after I started there, there was this really, really, really profound corruption scandal in New York City involving the New York City Parking Violations Bureau, which was a unit of the Department of Transportation. That's how my transportation career got started, because I got drawn into that. They needed all hands on deck. So I joined with my colleague, who was the DOT analyst, and I got involved in helping to sort of manage this elements of the scandal, you know, because it involved the Parking Violations Bureau generated in those days, I think, $250 million in revenue, which was actually the third highest revenue source for the city of New York in those days. So it was very big. So I won't get into the details of the pretty salacious scandal, but that's actually how I backed into the transportation side. And then I became the DOT analyst.
Wow. Yeah. I guess it's true. Every era of New York sounds like it would make a great movie. But you
I think
were really
so,
living
yeah.
it.
Yeah. I mean, from Koch to Dinkins, and before I left, Giuliani was in his first term as mayor. So yeah, I lived through interesting. I also got a very good understanding of, not to get political particularly, but the challenges of people in their third terms, because I started when Koch was in his second term and I was there in his third term. He was a hero in his first term because he helped save New York from the depths of Abeam and bankruptcy. In his second term, he was still popular and doing good things. By his third term, he was a crotchety old man.
Yeah.
And I've sort of, you know, 8 years is a long time as public official, and I think it's the rare elected official in an executive capacity that beyond their second term that can continue to really be effective.
Are you also seeing the recovery of New York?
Well,
that time?
You know, yes. Oh, absolutely. When I was there, I mean, it was, you know, the terrible 70s, the rebuilding had begun, the population loss had been stemmed. Of course, the subway system, they'd spent the entire 80s rebuilding the subway system. There were still a lot of problems. You know, and I will credit one thing. I think when Giuliani was elected and when he started, he really did begin to get a handle on the crime issue in New York City, along with his police chief, Bill Bratton, who, when I started at New York City Transit, he was the transit police chief. So for those who know criminal justice, Bill Bratton is a pretty well-known guy.
You're still looking at all of this through management, through policy. Do you have a love affair yet with transit?
Well, so, you know, again, I kind of got in the transit industry slightly by mistake. My boss in my previous jobs in New York City went over and started up a new Department of Customer Services at New York City Transit as a senior vice president. And he said, why don't you come along? So I came along, and within a few months, I became chief of operations planning for New York City Transit. And my love affair, actually, with transit is it's this really, really cool mixture of public policy, public service, and running a business. Because whether you're in New York City, Tacoma, Washington, Seattle, or Vancouver, if you think of it this way, if you conceptualize your role in public transit, we're in a competitive environment. Now, in New York, it's arguable what you're competing against because most everyone needs to take the subway, but really everyone still has a choice. You can still walk, you can still drive, you can still take a cab, and of course now, you know, Uber and so forth. So one of the really fun things that I gravitated to right off the bat in New York City Transit was, all right, if we think of ourselves as a business and we're trying to grow market share, we're trying to just sell more goods, what's selling more goods in public transit is people taking the train and bus. How do you drive ridership growth? And I've been trying to figure out ways to drive ridership growth ever since I was chief of operations planning in New York. Bus route by bus route basis, A-line, different train lines, figure out neat ways to attract more market share. And I've been fortunate each of the places I've been able to be part of driving increased market share. But that's what's fun about our business, is that it's not just a classic social service. It's actually trying to think of yourself as a consumer product and running yourself as a lean, mean, growth-oriented consumer product organization focused on the customer. And I get off on that.
That sounds very American.
And why is that not Canadian?
Yeah, that's what you bring to us. I notice you say train and bus. People talk about New York. I do. You talk transit, you think subway. You say bus.
So when I got to New York City Transit, which was in 1991, so they had spent the decade of rebuilding the train system, and successfully. We were still doing it when I was there. But what that meant was all of the talent, all of the attention, and all of the money went to the subway. None of the talent, none of the attention, and none of the money went to the bus. Just like here in Vancouver, more people took the bus than took the subway. And there were large portions of New York City that don't have subways and needed the bus. So the bus was really being ground down, and nobody was really, it was just out there, and the buses would run. Their on-time performance was not good. There was lots of overcrowd. No one was paying attention to it. So I paid attention to it, and I could pull the levers because my Department of Customer Services included operations planning, which in New York City Transit is a very powerful group. We also had the marketing department, we had the government affairs department, and we had the customer service group, the people that answered the telephones. So we pulled all that stuff together, and you know, I could pull a lot of strings, and I happened to be pretty effective at putting ideas forward to the president of the TA, and we were able to do good things. And I worked very well with the budget people because I figured out ways to, you know, make up a number. You know, if only I got, you know, $500,000 for a little marketing campaign, I can move around some service hours because I pull those levers at operations planning. I can also put up better bus stop signs because I'm in charge of that. Well, I can create a nice little market for that new bus route. And okay, here's the money. Go experiment with stuff. I mean, one of the things I learned in graduate school was experimental design. And I've taken that with me everywhere. Is, all right, how do you kind of think of, you know, a well thought out premise or a hypothesis to try to accomplish something, you know, construct it like a little experiment, prove to the people that need to get money. You do that as a former professor, getting grant funding and stuff in a sense. And let's try something. And let's, in upfront, identify the success metrics, go and study it 6 months and 18 months later and see, here are the pieces we put together. I theorize if we do all these things, I can grow ridership by 10 or 15% on this bus route that nobody ever paid attention to. And guess what? It worked.
You were Jeanette Sadik-Khan before there was a Jeanette Sadik-Khan as transportation commissioner.
Well, I know Jeanette pretty well. Jeanette, when I was at the Transit Authority, she was the mayor's transportation advisor. So yes, I know when in the Dinkins administration. So yes, she and I go way back. Yeah. I have to say, if Jeanette's listening, she'll sort of remember. She and I would have some shouting matches over the telephone over various different and sundry
New
issues.
Yorkers.
But we do go
New
way
Yorkers.
Back, yes.
Huh. Yeah. Hey, we're going to come back to this, but I got to jump ahead. You said that there's this bias towards the subway in New York, and the same in Vancouver.
There's a bias in most transit agencies towards heavy rail versus bus.
And that's
because
true
heavy
in Vancouver.
Rail is generally because that is where the money and the talent tends to go. It's just, it's, I don't know how that evolved over many, many, many years, but I've seen that play out. Even in Seattle, I mean, you know, when once Link Light Rail and it started coming up, the powers that be got rather more fixated on rail, not so much as opposed to bus, because we had a damn good bus system in and it still is in Seattle, but you just move to the sex appeal. You move to where the billions of dollars go. It's a natural thing. It's what politicians want to do. They want to build big things. Buses are not sexy. And I took it as a mission of mine, and it started in New York, to reject that buses aren't sexy and reject that buses are for losers. And to say, we can build a bus system that can work for all walks of life if we just assume that all walks of life should use the bus. And we can step up the quality of the bus service. And it actually isn't that hard to do it.
Well, I'm going to say this because I don't think you can, but I believe that reflects why Surrey and its political leaders want SkyTrain. And why in West Vancouver, at least some people, don't want feline. That bias seems to be pervasive. And you see it as your job of changing that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to wade into the politics of either of those topics. And, you know, even in West Vancouver, it's not that people in West Vancouver didn't want beeline. I think what was going on in West Vancouver about, you know, taking out parking in front of retail shops that maybe have pretty low profit margins in a village environment in Ambleside and Dunderave, and they equated the beeline with change.
Yes, I
think not so
true.
Much because, you know, West Vancouver had some of the highest growth rates in bus ridership over the last couple of years of any other of the cities. Yeah.
I mean,
That's true. And, you know, one of our board members lives in West Van and she takes the bus and public transit all the time. So it's not so much that they were turning their back on transit because I think they appreciate transit connections. I think it was the nature of and speed with which change might be coming to that community. Now, Surrey, I think, is different. Different things were at play, you know, in Surrey, the light rail versus SkyTrain.
I noticed that you've referenced Tacoma and Seattle several times. Why?
Well, after my years in New York, for quality of life reasons, my wife and I decided to move. And I struck out and moved to Tacoma, took a job sight unseen, took a very large pay cut for a quality of life change. But
what does that mean, by the way, quality of life? What quality of life?
Well, I was living in the Bronx. My kids were of a certain age, and they were 7 and 9 on their way to the next level of public schooling. I love the outdoors, as does my wife. I met my wife on a camping trip. And we wanted to be in a place that was closer to nature and the outdoors than the Bronx, because anywhere, if you want to go anywhere other than Van Cortlandt Park, which I could walk to from my home, you had to drive a long way in a lot of traffic, and it was a pain in the neck. Just going to the beach in the summer to Jones Beach was like an ordeal. So we wanted to be closer to nature. But I also saw what was going on in the Puget Sound after a failed vote in 1994 for the regional transit system. They put it back on it. They revamped it. It was going to be on the ballot a month after I moved there in October of 1996. And in November was the second round vote for what became Sound Transit. So I was kind of betting on the come that that would happen and I could be on the ground floor of the beginnings of a major regional transit network. And that happened. And eventually that led to me getting the job as the head of King County Metro. So I'd been at Pierce Transit for about 8 years and King County Metro for 12 years running the system. I was part of building the regional network, building initially the express buses in the regional network, supporting the light rail, the little light rail in Tacoma. And when I was in Seattle, we operated Link Light Rail. So we were very much part and parcel of bringing the light rail system up.
How is that legacy changing Seattle?
They're still building. I mean, they had the successful vote called Sound Move, ST1, if you will, in 1996. They went for ST2 after some bad years. At the end of the decade, beginning of the 2000s, they had a couple really, really dark years because of scope and budget on their program. Great leadership brought them back up. They went out for another successful vote, kind of modest in 2007, and then in 2016, they went for the gusto, $54 billion tax package that passed with 55% or so of the vote in the three counties. So they've got a 25-year plan at $54 billion to build out the high-capacity, largely light rail system, some BRT routes, improving commuter rail, but it's mostly light rail. So it's in the process of transforming because the line still is basically the airport to the University of Washington. Look at it 5 or 10 years from now. It's expanding to, it opens at Northgate, further north in a couple of years. It'll be out towards Bellevue in a couple of years as well.
They have added service though. They have extended the line and they're losing transit ridership.
No, they are gaining transit ridership.
Seattle is.
So I'm proud to say that the two leading regions in North American transit ridership are number one, Vancouver, by a long shot. Number two is Seattle.
I thought it was Toronto.
So last year, our ridership grew here in Vancouver about 6%, which we haven't seen the numbers from the National Transit Database, but I'm sure that will lead all of North America. The Seattle metropolitan region led the United States with 3%. And that's also informed my positioning on ride-hailing because, you know, ride-hailing came to Seattle in 2013, and we were coming off the Great Recession. We at King County Metro were able to start adding back some service, and it didn't hurt our ridership.
Uh-huh.
So
conclusion?
Conclusion,
then?
Conclusion is if you put out a really good transit product, and there are other public policy factors in play that are favorable towards transit, it's not something to be feared. And it can also make you sharper in your competitive offerings. So it doesn't worry me. When ride hailing comes here, will it take some of our ridership? Sure. Will it make us sharper that we have to provide, you know, step up our game? It should, and it will. And I also see the potential of partnership opportunities. Where ride hailing, you can associate it with diminished transit ridership or in places, let's say New York. New York, the subway is completely overwhelmed and it's beginning to increasingly break down. The buses, you can walk faster than taking a bus. So then Uber comes, well, why not? What's the alternative? The alternative is not great. Los Angeles, which is seeing very, very significant ridership loss, you know, and no offense to my colleagues in Los Angeles, Los Angeles is this big sprawling community, has a long way to go to build effective transit. And that's Measure M. That's what they're trying to do. It's no surprise in a car-centric culture that the coming of Uber, you know, is much more convenient than a transit system that still has a long way to go in a place like LA. So my conclusion is, yes, where ride-hailing is diminishing transit ridership in many cities, it probably has a lot to do with the nature of the transit system, the quality of the transit system, and other urban dynamics, as opposed to just the mere fact that ride-hailing is going to steal transit ridership. That's why I think we have a really good transit system here in this region, and there are other dynamics in play that will not, I think, hurt our transit ridership and our bottom line particularly.
So from your view in King County, you can look north, see a lot of nice outdoor stuff. And what kind of city? What was your view of Vancouver from King County?
Well, we, you know, people would ask me that when I got here in 2016. And why'd you come to Vancouver? Well, we in the Seattle region, when I was coming in, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s, we would look to Vancouver and want to be like Vancouver. We didn't have a rail system. We didn't have intense development around transit stations. Transit-oriented development, big buzz phrase in the 2000s and the 1990s in the United States, and very, very slow movement to develop TOD, real TOD. All you had to do is come up here and see it. And now you see it there. I've never been to a city anywhere in the U.S. or Canada that has the kind of development around our SkyTrain stations. And what we're seeing under development now, it's absolutely phenomenal. So we would, from the Seattle lens, from the Puget Sound lens, we'd look at it and say, we want to be like Vancouver.
Yeah, I think we need to look not south or east, but West Asia to see comparables.
Yes.
How to do it better, but at that scale.
I agree.
Well, now, what was, bullshit when you came to Vancouver and you realized, here's their myth, I can see a reality?
Myth versus reality. I'm not sure. I've never thought about it. Myth versus reality. I don't have rose-colored glasses. I began to see a lot more about what's good about our transit system, and from the inside, I can see the same problems with our transit system that I had in New York and in Seattle.
So you weren't surprised at how much we dish it here?
Oh God, no. Everybody dishes.
Yeah.
Everybody dishes. You know, every city loves to rag on, if not despise, its transit system. And when you're in your transit system, you're going to be much more critical of it. When I would, you know, in my perch as the general manager of King County Metro, I'd see customer comments and stuff, and comments from grizzled old, you know, Seattleites, your bus sucks, right? And then I'd have visitors come to town and they'd send these nice letters, or people that had not used the system and ventured into our system. And I'd get these beautiful letters from people and say, you have the best transit system I've ever been to. I live in such and such city and your system rocks. So when you go outside your element and then you can look at it from the outside, well, actually, there's something cool going on. The first time I went to Toronto, I think in 2017, I was meeting with my colleagues from Metrolinx. And there happened to be, the Toronto system, they get ripped apart, you know, whether it's Metrolinx or TTC often. So, you know, the media in Toronto, you know, treats its transit system tough, as does the general public. And there was an editorial in the newspaper in Toronto, and it was just gushing about, of all things, TransLink's really effective governance. Huh. And we were seeing this over dinner with our colleagues from Metrolinx, and it was an uproarious laugh, because back here, everyone was, governance, crazy, terrible governance in Vancouver. Actually, our governance is pretty darn good. I mean, I've seen it all. Every metropolitan region that has a major metro region that has a transit system has cockamamie governance.
Hey, it's Kevin complicated Desmond, stuff. The reason TransLink's images change is because we have a face. It happens to be yours. But up until that point, who was TransLink? Was it the board? Was it the mayor's council? I mean, and you would say that was you like that TransLink? You like that governance?
Well, the problem wasn't the governance. You just said what the problem was, didn't you? The leadership, not the governance.
Huh. Texas?
If with good leadership, you can manage the governance. And I'm not saying if I were here in 2014 or 2015 or 2009, I might have done any better than anybody else. But my governance in King County was more complicated than here. I had three political bosses. Very, very active political bosses. Here, I really only have one, plus a really excellent professional board. It's complicated no matter where you are. I would much prefer my governance here than my colleagues in New York City right now, that's for sure.
Texas, New York, Seattle, that covers off a good part of American culture.
West College in Maine.
Yeah. New England, all right. 49th parallel. What do you see different?
Really not a lot, you know, from my perch, you know, as a transit CEO, there really isn't a lot different. I mean, the biggest difference, really, between Vancouver and most anywhere in other than the northeast portion of the United States is the acceptance of density. So this city is much more accepting of density, much more like Asia, from what I've seen in Asia. United States version of TOD is an 8-story wood frame building, set back from, with probably a parking lot between the transit station and the building. That's density. So Americans are not as willing and accepting of density and living in condos and big tall towers and a lot of towers concentrated next to each other. And I think that's one of the success factors of our transit system and the mobility in this region. That's really the biggest difference. Other than that, you know, people consume transportation the same way. You know, most of the people in this region drive to work. I mean, our market share is, you know, a journey to work market share is still only about 25-ish%, much higher in the city of Vancouver. So we still have a long way to go. That's not a lot different than in the market share that we had in the Puget Sound. Seattle and Vancouver's non-SOV market share is very, very similar. And the difference is we manage that with an excellent, excellent bus system, whereas here it's managed with an excellent SkyTrain system and abundant bus, not to mention C-Bus. Got to get C-Bus in there as well. So there's really not a lot of difference. The funding sources are not a lot different. There are variations and stuff, but the funding sources are, you know, they're the usual sources really to how you raise revenue for transit. Customers demand good service. They demand consistent service, and they demand to be told what's going on, and that's the same no matter where you are.
What's your favorite hike? Where do you like to go camping here?
Oh boy. I haven't done any camping here because my wife doesn't want to sleep on the ground anymore, primarily. We camp by kayak, though. We love to kayak, actually. That's a sort of a, we cross-country ski, we hike, we kayak. But my days of backpacking, maybe I can get with my son and son-in-law. My objective is to do the John Muir Trail in California someday, 200 miles in the Sierras. But
Canadian citizenship?
I doubt that. No, we'll see.
So you come and you look around through your public policy eyes, your management experience. What's the big challenge?
The challenge, I guess, multiple folds. Customer first. So it's I take service problems really, really seriously. You know, so when I get a text and when there's a delay on the train, there's a problem on the buses, people are being held up. I take that really seriously, very personally. Because, I mean, it goes back to the first conversation of growing up in New York. There's a for your listeners, you won't be able to see me, there's a posture that a New Yorker has. You're looking down the platform looking for the next train.
Yeah, yeah.
And nobody tells you a damn thing. The only way you know another train is coming, you can feel the air first from the piston effect in the tunnels, right? So I come from it from the ground floor of understanding the frustration of a transit customer. I took transit in New York. When I lived in New York, I lived in the Bronx and worked in Brooklyn and Midtown Manhattan. When I lived in the Puget Sound region, I took transit to and from Tacoma and Seattle each and every day. So I get just as frustrated and aggravated when the system doesn't work as any of our customers. So it bothers me. So I want to make sure when we're having a bad day that we treat our customers as best we can and get them out of that bad day as quickly as we can. And what I found is people are more, customers are more forgiving of a delay if you're telling them what's going on. Tell them what to expect. Okay, here's what's going on, here's why, here's what to expect, and we're gonna keep you informed. I've been on a commuter trail rail line in Seattle, sitting on the train for 2.5 hours waiting for the train to move. And those 2.5 hours went by a lot more quickly because the conductor was really great and kept us informed of what's going on. It's just an illustration. I would have been a basket case. You know, my cell phone battery was almost dead if we had not heard what was going on. But he was telling us that he was just doing a great job. I've been on buses where a bus operator is really chatty and does a good job of keeping the customers engaged. That's a fun ride as opposed to, you know, the alternative. So I start with the customer. That's what's most important to me, is making sure that we're providing good, consistent service each and every day for the customer, coming up with new ideas to provide a fun and positive experience for customers. That's the first side.
A fun experience?
Yeah.
How do you mean?
Double-decker buses, sitting on the top of a double-decker buses gives you a little bit of a fun factor now on your transit trip. That's one of the reasons we're getting double-decker buses.
A gondola? A gondola?
Did you used to work at Simon Fraser University? Is that why you're asking me about
not
that?
Not the hill.
No, and our wristbands, you know, the compass wristbands and stuff. There can be a fun factor to it. Sure, a gondola maybe someday. You know, you're going up and you're going fast up the hill and you're getting a view and stuff.
So cool.
Yeah. You know, I've often, when the first time I rode on the Evergreen line, the first time I rode on it, and it was a nice day, a clear day, it was a clear winter day. It was like, God, that view is fantastic. Yeah. You know, it's like the cheapest tourist ride. And I've been trying to figure out ways to think of SkyTrain as also a tourist rush. So we, just a few weeks ago, we launched this Dine the Line campaign. You know, we're partnering with a food entity. And it shows how you can use the Canada Line, the Expo Millennium Line, to get to different food and beverage, you know, breweries and stuff, and Asian food in Richmond. So you can think, wow, that's fun. You know, it's easy to get around. The Sea Bus is the cheapest freaking, just like the Staten Island Ferry, it's the cheapest tourist ride there is. And now how do you connect? I had the conversation with Daryl Masato, the mayor, former mayor of the city of North Vancouver. I said, Daryl, you know, how can we want to help market, you know, the market you have here in Lonsdale. There's some cool stuff here. And on a beautiful summer evening, you have stuff going on your plaza. You got live music, you got food, you got these outstanding views of the port and of Vancouver. We want to be part of that. You can have fun. So the second thing, back to your question, is public consensus. right? Going back to that 2014-2015 period in TransLink, you didn't have consensus. People were arguing. The mayors were arguing. The mayors were mad at TransLink. TransLink didn't have a voice. There was just turmoil. People were not focused on the issue. What was the issue? Improving transportation. They were focused on other drama. My job is to keep people focused on the message so that that public consensus, the intergovernmental affairs, giving our policymakers at the province and in Ottawa, and particularly at the local level with the mayors, the freedom to focus on really important public policy issues. So my job and my team's job, all 7,500 of us at TransLink, is to deliver on what we promise to do.
Karen Feeding of the media?
Karen Feeding of the media, very important, yes. So I will spend as much time with the media as possible. I'll be very candid. The first, press conference I did, I think it was after a board meeting. There was a lot of press and not as many show up anymore. We're not as interesting, I guess, to the press sometimes, but a lot of press was there. And the person from our comms team was sort of running the Q&A, and after like 8 questions or something, the comms were like, okay, that's enough questions. And I kind of looked at her, I said, no, bring it on. I'm gonna stay here until you're done asking me questions.
Performance artist.
And I'm going to continue to do that. I will wear you out. But I mean, you have questions, we're going to answer your questions. I'm not going to shy away. And if I can't answer your question, I'll say, I don't know the answer, we're going to get back to you. So I think that's part of building trust and respect with the media as opposed to being handled. Because yeah. I didn't like that. I thought that was wrong. And if I was a reporter saying, ooh, she's handling him. Are you hiding something? You don't want to talk to us? Ah, there's something there. No, there's nothing there. Bring it on. I'll answer every question I can.
What are they asking you these days?
When are the double-decker buses coming? I get that all the time.
They want fun too?
Yeah. No, the fairly standard questions, what's going on with the Expo Millennium Line, the Broadway subway, what's going on in Surrey, what are we doing about late-night service downtown, double-decker buses, standard stuff. But I'm always there for the media.
What about the future?
Well, the future is our long-range plan. You know, our Transport 2050. And the future is...
Transport 2050.
Yeah, well, you and I may not be here.
Then, oh, my God.
But it's coming.
I sat on the TransLink board and council, and I'd seen these plans, Transportation 2040 and Transport 2021, and I can't remember the difference.
You know what, though, Gord? So as we were getting ready to sort of launch the public side of this, I was reminded that the long-range plan that was issued here in 1993, you would know better whatever the governmental body was in those days, most of what was in that plan has either been implemented or is being implemented. I mean, it's astonishing. And even with a lot of the political challenges and turmoil of building out SkyTrain in this region, it still got done. Somehow it got done, despite, you know, maybe some of the political challenges of getting it done and maybe changing the order of things, but the lines on the map are still the lines on the map that we're working on. That hasn't really changed. And I think that that's also a very, very good indication of the way that this region has managed its land use and managed to stick to, you know this better, you're far more expert on this than I am, but these are going to be the growth centers. And if we really can stick to that, you can then plan out your transit system much more effectively if you know where your growth centers are going to be, because that's where you should put your high-capacity transit investments. So I think this plan, if we really do it well, is not going to gather dust. It will be the roadmap for the future, and that's what we want it to be.
I don't think they gather dust. I just don't think you can remember the names of them.
Well, that's true. Well, that might be the case. But no, I'm psyched. I'm really, really excited to see what comes out of it. I really am.
Okay. Share that excitement in a real way. Make it something more than a word. What is exciting about a visionary document, about a process?
Well, first of all, there's absolutely nothing exciting about a process. I don't like process. I'm very impatient with process. But besides the point, what will be exciting about it is how to get there and hearing from the public, because we hope that this is going to be the largest public engagement in TransLink's history. You know, we've got a great website going. We've already got thousands of people that have logged into the website, taken the survey. People can post their ideas, you know, like on a pinup kind of thing, and everybody can see what the ideas are.
I want more and better. And I don't want you to move.
By the way, guess what?
One of the, I don't want
favorite,
another.
No, one of the favorite ideas that in, at least in terms of numbers, Andrew Petter, you've done a good job, is the gondola, right? But I mean, there's an idea you need to run the Canada Line from Horseshoe Bay to the Trois.
Yeah, I want more. I want
for
better.
Example.
What else is the public going to tell you? Come on, they don't have to make the trade-offs.
Well, I
can
you know,
they
I
even
think
imagine the technology of the world we're going into?
Well, that's true, but we're and that's partly our job. So that's where the bureaucrats and the planners need to help, is to help put in front of people, you know, what is automation going to bring? What is electrification going to bring? How might climate change and sea level rises affect, you know, how this region, because this region is very threatened by that, obviously, how that's going to affect, you know, land use, which therefore affects mobility. So the exciting part of it is just trying to pull all that stuff together and try to reflect back the dreams that people have on how their values are reflected out in their mobility ideas, and how we can fuse that with our really smart planners who are also looking out on the future on the things like, you know, automation and so forth, and try to fuse ideas into what possible scenario outcomes might look like and how we can be agile. I mean, 1993, the pace of change was much slower than now in 2019. And that makes long-range planning probably harder now than it was 20 years ago or 40 years ago. So that's there are more uncertainties, I think, now in a certain sense than maybe even in 1993.
Dreams are powerful, and you need them, particularly in a position like yours. But we've had that dream since the 70s, cities in a sea of green, rooted even back to the 50s. Mm-hmm. And we've maintained that vision. You can see it reflected, as you said, in the town centers. Do you expect to hear something different than a reiteration of that vision? And should you? Should we depart from it?
You know, I so far, I haven't seen anything different than that. I think the big change is the growth of the region. You know, there's a lot more talk about what happens in the Fraser Valley, what happens up Sea to Sky Highway. So it's the growth of the region. I think an interesting case could be made, and I'm not throwing out a trial balloon, it's just a case could be made. Does the broader region need to think of larger concentrated commercial job centers even outside of our territory, further into the valley? You know, where are the jobs of the future going to be that are associated with affordable housing, where you have so much of the land already taken up, you know, in this region? So I'll be interested to see how, because we're going to hear a lot, and that's actually part of our agenda, is reaching out to the Fraser Valley District and up the Sea to Sky corridor to see how we further connect those corridors.
You've convinced me on that. I would say yes, if we could extend that vision, that would be exciting. If you could eliminate half the labor force of TransLink through automation, is that just inevitable? Would you want to do that?
I would not touch that question with a 10-foot pole. It's, you know, had a conversation with a union person, a fairly prominent labor person, some time ago when we were starting our new mobility work at TransLink. And he used a phrase that I'd never heard before, just transition. That's a very important phrase, because I feel that. You know, some may think, people who think about automation, that the first major transportation component to fully automate is trucking, because there's a lot of logic around that. You can do the caravans of trucks on the highways and so forth. They can go very close together, high speed, et cetera, et cetera. So I forget the number, of something like 300,000 jobs or something in the trucking business, or maybe it's 3 million. I forget. It's huge. There's a lot of truckers in North America.
Well, at least three.
They're not going to have a job anymore? Or there might be one for every 10 trucks going forward? Fast forward to TransLink. Coast Mountain Bus Company has 3,500 bus operators. Those are really good jobs. What happens to those jobs? Where do they go? We have to think about those things. Will buses be automated someday in the future? Sure. Is it something that's going to happen tomorrow? No, it's a long way away. Should we be thinking about that? Sure, we have a leg up because we have an automated train system, one of the few in North America. But we've got to manage it from a just transition. These are good jobs. They've got good benefits. They're good middle class jobs. And I think society needs to, as we move further into this brave new world of automation and artificial intelligence, we have to be thinking about what the jobs of the future are. What happens in medicine, for heaven's sakes? And that's going to happen sooner. Automated medicine, automated diagnostics. My wife's in medicine. That's going to happen sooner than fully automated vehicles. And what happens to those professional jobs? Where do they go?
I just want to add a footnote on bus drivers because, you know, I interact with them every day. And they're good. How they put up with the stress of dealing with the public and still maintain their professionalism. I think it's the reason why we say thank you when we...
Everybody should say thank you to their bus operator. I often say it's probably the hardest job in our business.
I think they get tired of hearing thank you.
But you got to do it. I mean, every time I'm on the bus, I always say thanks to the bus operator. It's a tough job it's a very tough job.
Now, okay, so if you imagine a future moving away from the hardware and the automation, where let's say Google, Uber, Amazon, and who knows else all get together with a hedge fund and want to be the telecommunications version of transportation, offer you a service plan, integrate all forms of transportation. Do you think we should sell them the transit system so it could be integrated?
Sell them the transit system. I doubt they'd want to buy the transit system. Why would they?
Because
it's heavily tax supported. You can't make a profit on it.
I can offer you a complete transportation package. You don't need to own a car. And once I've got you...
In the company X that might have a large regional or worldwide fleet of vehicles that will be automated in the future and probably electrified, that could be managed very effectively centrally to create very effective personal transport. They probably have an idea to try to corner the market on that and make a lot of money for their investors. I don't think those systems will be able to compete with high capacity, grade separated, exclusive rapid transit under any circumstance. So I think the future of that type of service remains bullish. Why Company X would want to take over the responsibility for that very, very complicated and expensive very publicly important infrastructure, I don't know the business case for that, to be honest with you. We should be partnering with Company X, though, and that's probably inevitable in some form to be determined. We can, as we look in the future, we can probably conjure up lots of different ways those partnerships might happen. I just hope it's not ruinously competitive, because that will hurt both Company X's bottom line, and it will ultimately hurt the tax-supported, very, very important public transit that we have to have. I mean, public transit is important because it levels the playing field for everyone in terms of price. It brings everybody together efficiently. I was on the train in my suit coming downtown today, and I'm often on the train with everybody else on the train. And that's cool, and that's democracy, and that's how it should be.
That's what I say in New York.
And you need, of course it is. And you need, in my view, you need publicly supported service like that that's available to everybody equally.
Do you want to go back to New York?
maybe to visit. I still have family there. No, after reconciling, if my wife and I reconciled myself in the first 2 years of living in the Pacific Northwest with the desperately long winters and lousy pizza, we decided we like it out here, yes.
Yeah, good bagels.
No. You still got to go to New York for a bagel,
right?
And a schmear.
Okay. What's next for Kevin Desmond?
Next for Kevin Desmond is getting the Transport 2050 plan done and getting a phase 3 funding plan done with the mayors, both of which next year. I think that we have a lot of ground to cover. You know, the sky's the limit for us. This is a good problem to have, the ridership that we have and the ridership growth. So, you know, I want to help this region forge the next investment plan for the next level of expansions that are, I think, really important for the region.
I want to go back to New York with you. I want to ride the number 5. I want to see the city through your eyes and let's change.
We'll do that. Let's make a date.
Great. Well, you know, you spent a Friday afternoon. That's really valuable time.
Yeah. It's my pleasure.
It was our pleasure, I hope.
It's a good conversation.
Let's do it again.
Okay.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Corey.